Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We have smartphones, smart watches, smart cars, and smart televisions. Some of them catch on, obviously, and some, such as the smart television, haven't yet, and some say they never will. Joining us now to talk about those dire predictions for smart TV is Gary Meyer. He's a digital media consultant who recently wrote about smart TVs for Wired. Welcome to the show, Gary.
Thanks. Good to be with you, Ann.
So you're down on smart TVs. First of all, let's tell people what they are and distinguish them.
Sure. Well, smart TVs, I would say, would be considered internet-enabled or connectable to the internet so that you can get other services that are available on the internet on your home television.
All right. So why, you know, you say in your article that they're still the rage. But they're not necessarily going to make it.
Well, I think it's a little bit complicated. The consumer electronics manufacturers, I think, are afraid that their televisions are going to be relegated to being dumb screens. And by that, I mean just a piece of glass where you view whatever programming you want to see. So they are trying to hold on to some value-added functionality so that the television can be used more than just viewing programming that comes over your cable, satellite, or telco service. And so that's kind of driving the whole thing. And the problem is there are several factors involved here. One is that there's no industry standard for any of this. Number two is that the technology that's driving the internet technology is changing much faster than television technology, which is pretty old by computer standards. The last thing is it's been kind of a long time coming where people are desperately trying to hope for a convergence of television with the computer. And this is what the TV manufacturers are trying to make happen through these smart televisions.
So what kinds of apps are available on these TVs? Are there any apps that are unique to smart TVs, or are they mostly just the kind you can get on a smartphone like Netflix and Pandora?
Well, so yes, that's exactly right. So depending on the manufacturer, they have different apps available. They've got the Netflix, they've got Hulu, they've got Pandora, Skype, Twitter, Facebook, and the like. Which effectively is nothing more than what web TV was back in 1996. Not to say that any of this is wrong, because a lot of these services kind of supplement your standard television programming. But my argument that I make in the article is really what needs to happen here at the television is the next platform or ecosystem for the consumer. We've had it recently in smartphones, where they basically have turned into portable computers and enable you to do all kinds of things remotely. And I'm just waiting for the next thing to happen at the television to create this ecosystem.
My guest is Gary Meyer. He's former president of Sony Digital Media of America and a consultant to the digital media industry. If you have a question or comment for him about the smart TV industry, give us a call, 614-292-8513. How popular are smart televisions? Are people just sort of buying them just because they're out there and it's the next step in their minds? Do they cost more than regular TVs? What does that look like right now?
Well, the range of products available in television is pretty broad, but at the higher end, flat screens, LCD TVs, the higher quality ones, they tend to be smart TVs because they put more features in these things, and so that's what the capabilities are with these smart TVs.
And are they popular?
Yes, they are popular. I mean, a lot of people, a fair amount of people, hook them up and want to get Netflix over them or Facebook or do these other things with them. So there's absolutely nothing wrong with them. It's just I see the next phase coming in the future where there'll be much more than this.
Tell me about what you see coming up in the future.
So I would say in the ideal world, what comes up in the future is that you're in your home and you get recommendations on your television from your friends about a movie that they've just started watching. Why don't you join them? And you click in and you're able to watch the same movie that they are. while you're using your tablet and your lap to communicate what you think about the movie and what your opinions are going along. This is the social component of it. The other piece of it is kind of the long-awaited interactivity, which people have been talking about for a long time. I'm a little bit more skeptical about that because television tends to be what's called a lean-back experience mm-hmm. as opposed to a lean-in experience.
Yeah, I don't even care about participating in those surveys when they on some of those competition shows. I don't know who does that.
Right, exactly. I'm the same way. I agree with you. I think the other piece that's going to happen here with television is there's been a lot of conversation around unbundling and making more television programming a la carte. And I think what's got to happen is, in order for that to happen, to make the economics work for the television industry, they are used to their financial system working, the business model working around bundling everything. In other words, you may want to watch only one program, but you've got to buy a whole series of programming in a package to get that one program.
Right.
In order to make it cost-effective to unbundle that, the dynamics of the advertising market has to change.
Okay, so how would that change?
So you may have heard about the term, it's very common now, the word big data. And the word big data really comes around getting a lot of information about things and people so that advertisers can learn more and more accurately put advertising in front of you that you may be interested in. Instead of the old blanket approach of advertising to everybody in a shotgun manner, the more efficient way would be to find out if you have an interest in taking an upcoming vacation, that you might be interested in this specific advertisement talking about vacations that are available right now on sale. And the only way to know that is to monitor what your viewing habits are and understand a little bit more about you, which kind of slides a little bit more into the privacy dilemma because people don't want to know, you know, people are a little concerned about, you know, companies knowing all about their personal lives. But the trade-off here is the more that the television advertisers can learn about you as a viewer, the more accurately that they can put the right ad in front of you at the right time, and they're willing to pay more for that.
But this would require that two-way.
Correct. That is correct.
And that's the privacy problem.
Correct.
You wrote that 40% of people who have internet-enabled televisions haven't even connected them to the internet. And my next question is, why aren't they using this feature on their TV sets? And I'm just going to guess, because a lot of people who can afford these televisions aren't necessarily in the demographic that wants to hook them up to the internet.
That's part of it. I think the other part about it is the dilemma with a lot of companies in this industry tend to think that everybody thinks like they do and everybody is equally technologically savvy. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit of work to set these things up to your wireless internet connection in your home, making it work with your router and all the other parameters that you need to make this thing work right in your home. And a lot of people, like in the early days of VCRs, when they had the blinking 12 on them, you know, never set the clocks, you know?
But they just buy them because it happens to be the highest end television. They want the screen. They like everything else about it and just comes with it.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
What is a set-top box, and why do you believe that's the better option than the smart TV?
So a set-top box is if you have satellite or cable or telco television, pay TV basically, anything that you get your pay TV service off of, there's a set-top box that's associated with that that connects to your television, and that set-top box does all the tuning to all the channels that you want to get through your provider. My argument is basically this set-top box can be changed out very quickly and can go along with the flow of technology much quicker than that television that you've invested in that you hope will last about, you know, 8 to 10 years. And so rather than waiting for the next cycle to get your next television to get the latest technology, by buying a set-top box, you can get the latest and greatest for probably under $200.
But it is could kill the television manufacturers, right? Or at least as we know them.
Well, I mean, I don't think they're ever going to be killed. The problem is it's really relegating them then to a commodity, which is what we talked about at the beginning of this conversation, mm-hmm. and that is they don't want to be going down that path because that just means build me a box with a piece of glass and a tube, you know, a flat screen in it, and I'll get my technology and hardware from and electronics from somewhere else to plug into this thing.
Where does the cable industry play a role in all of this? They must they don't like either option, I would imagine.
Well, obviously, they'd like to remain in control of the television service, the entertainment service that gets to your home. The small dilemma that they have is they're kind of regional and fractionated, as opposed to a satellite service, which is nationwide, but has other issues in terms of connectivity and having a two-way nature to it that cable does. The other advantage of that your cable operator has is no matter what happens with the TV service that you choose, you're invariably going to end up needing cable or telco to get your internet service at your home.
Hmm. And what about things like Roku and Apple TV? Is that like the set-top boxes?
They are. That's exactly right. They're the set-top box for what's called the over-the-top or OTT market. And by over-the-top, that means those companies, Roku and Apple TV, are providing video service over the top of your cable system, that is, using your cable system to drive other services to your television in addition to your pay TV service.
And how Roku makes its money just in the hardware, or is there advertising associated with that too?
There's no advertising associated with it. Right now, Roku is just a facilitator for driving on over-the-top applications to your television. So they basically sell the hardware box.
What is your prediction for that two-way television anyway, given the privacy concerns that people have? What do you think is going to happen?
I think it needs to be very subtle. I think it can't be in your face and overt. As we know, just in our dealings with, you know, the recent news with the NSA and,
right,
and all the other activities that somehow people are finding out what we're doing anyway, just through our normal, you know, operations using the web. It needs to be very laid back in terms of subtlety, in terms of what you're going to be asked to contribute to a television content provider. That being said, you know, you go to the web today and you browse around a little bit, and all of a sudden you're noticing, after you've just checked out some shoes online, that the next time you go to Facebook or anywhere else, boom, up comes an ad for some shoes. And you're going, well, wait a minute, how did that happen? Well, they're following what you're doing.
Yeah, I'm having a really big problem with a down coat right now that's following me all over wherever I go. But then I worry about let's say, you know, let's just take public television. We have underwriting. I still want to see those fancy commercials for the river cruises, the Viking river cruises, even though I can't imagine ever being able to afford to go on one. That's what bothers me about when the down coat's following me around. What am I not seeing?
Exactly. Well, it's that's the challenge, is to find out what you're interested in, what you'd like to see, and what you don't care about, and customizing that for every single viewer. And that's a tough problem.
Yeah. Well, thanks for talking about it with us today, Gary. I appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure.
Gary Meyer, he's former president of Sony Digital Media of America and a consultant to the digital media industry. He wrote an article for Wired this past week about how smart televisions might not be all they're cracked up to be. So we'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. And then coming up, more Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Last February, Yahoo CEO Marissa Mayer made some tech industry waves when she ended the company's telecommute policy for some workers. It was a surprising move in a place where progressive work cultures are more common. She said that she wanted more communication and collaboration at the office. Joining us now by phone from Los Angeles to talk about the remote work experience and how to enhance it is David Heinemeier Hansen. He is partner at the software technology company 37 Signals and co-author of a new book called Remote, Office Not Required. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Remote is possible because of technology. So the irony that a Silicon Valley giant like Yahoo has taken this tack is somewhat ironic. How many people actually telecommute? Do we even know that?
It's hard to get a precise reading on it, but it's in the single-digit percentage in the U.S. still. But it's growing fast, and I think that that's what's really exciting about this, is that we're not just at a stable level. The numbers that we've seen from the various levels of research there is that it's been growing really fast since about 2004, 2005. One number has it up something like 70% over that period. So it's still small, but it's growing fast, and I think that that's really what's exciting about all sorts of trends. Everything new, whether it's technology or it's principles, they will start slow, and then they'll grow big. And I think, as you say, it is really funny that Yahoo, of all companies, would be against remote work as a great way to collaborate, given the fact that they offer many tools online that make it easier for people to collaborate, web-based email and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm. As far as the growth goes, 70% over that period, that is big, even though we're starting with a small number. Is that in particular industries, or is that some kind of across-the-board growth? I obviously have to be in my studio at work to do my job.
Yes, and not every position, not every industry is yet ready for remote work, and some will never be. Obviously, the big target for remote work is knowledge workers of all kinds, people who sit in front of a computer or otherwise do intellectual work where they don't need to man a machine or they don't need to be in a specific studio in front of a specific piece of technology that they can't have at home. Mm-hmm. But the industry or business in general is certainly turning towards more knowledge workers. And the businesses that already are majority knowledge-based, whether it's design or programming or insurance or lawyers or lots of other areas of business where what you do mainly is analyze information and write your analysis or otherwise collaborate with people online, on the phone, or through other metrics like that.
So what about that idea of face-to-face collaboration, the thing that drove, the Yahoo CEO to change their policy?
Yes, face-to-face collaboration is always going to be important. What is overstated in this instance is how often is this important? Is it important to have it every day, multiple times a day? Our argument is certainly not. We still do all company meetings at 37 Signals, even though we're a very distributed company with 30 out of our 40 people spread out all over the place. We come together in one office about twice or three times a year. And that's great. It's really good to connect with people you haven't seen in a while. It's great to refresh the social bonds, but it's not something we need to do every day. In fact, it's counterproductive for us to do it every day. A big argument for being together is not just the social connection, but this idea that collaboration and great ideas can only happen if you're in the same room at the same time. Well, there's definitely some truth to that. I mean, we've all had the experience of sitting down and just bouncing ideas rapidly back and forth and felt like, wow, this was really productive, and this could probably only have happened at this level of fidelity when we're sitting face-to-face. That's great. Now, how often do you actually need that? How often do you need sort of an avalanche of new groundbreaking ideas? Well, you need it far less often than you need to actually implement those good ideas. If you just sit down every single day and come up with new ideas, when are you actually going to do those ideas? Greatness doesn't come from just dreaming up the impossible. It comes from actually doing the impossible. And you need dedicated time to do that. So if you reserve your face-to-face magic time to just a couple times a year, you'll actually have a chance to implement all those great ideas instead of just stuffing the backlog of good ideas even thicker with all the new stuff you come up with before you've had a chance to do any of the other stuff you've already come up with.
the whole idea of coming up with ideas and collaborating seems to me is such a fluid thing. And of course, you know, I'm from the olden days, so that's what we were forced to do. What about that water cooler interaction? What about the spontaneity of seeing people and talking to people and going, oh, yeah, when I see you, that makes me think of this?
Absolutely. Still hugely important. We do that at 37 Signals by having basically a virtual water cooler. We have a general chat room where the entire company hangs out all day. But unlike the office, people can opt in of when they want to basically be disturbed. When you're in the office, somebody can come over to your desk at any time and interrupt you on their schedule, mm-hmm. which is really not great. There's been tons of studies on the importance of sort of alone time and what happens to your productivity when somebody interrupts you when you're in a moment of flow. And especially if you're working on sort of a delicate piece of writing or design or program or wherever it is you're doing, if you get pulled out of your zone, it takes a long time to get back into it. There are estimates going from 15 to 45 minutes to get back into that groove you were in. Now imagine somebody coming over to your desk every 2 hours or so. It's very hard to get anything sustained done when that happens. Your entire workday gets chopped up into tiny little work moments. Versus if you have the sort of virtual water cooler where you opt in for when you're ready to have some social banter and so forth, it's on your schedule. It's in your natural work pattern. It's kind of like when you're asleep. If you get woken up in the wrong sleep cycle and REM sleep or whatever, you'll wake up all groggy. If you wake up in the right cycle, it'll be perfect and you'll be fresh and refreshed. Work is kind of the same way. You have to be interrupted at the right time. And the right time is when you're not deep in thought on something important. So for us, we have this virtual water cooler, a chat room, entire company hangs out. And we post all sorts of stuff in there. Some of it is work-based. Some of it is just funny pictures. Some of it is an article that we've read that we'd like others to read and so forth. So we have that social banter and that social connection and that sort of, hey, by the way, Jonas, can you have a look at this notion at the office? But it's opt-in and it's on the employee's schedule when it fits.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's Tech Tuesday, and I'm talking with David Hansen. He's author of Remote Office Not Required. If you work in a remote situation, you work from home, you don't have to be in an office, you can do it all by computer, give us a call and tell us how it works. 614-292-8513. We have about 10 minutes left, so there's plenty of time. Get your call in. 614-292-8513. Obviously, the CEO at Yahoo made a policy change because it wasn't working for them, but it's altogether possible that they weren't doing it right. Right?
There's a way to do this. First of all, they were in somewhat of a special situation. The company had sort of been rudderless for a long time. They've had, what, 5 CEOs over 5 years? Mm-hmm. No wonder that that the place is a mess. And a new person comes in and they want to clean up the mess. I can completely understand that. But perhaps it wasn't so prudent to sort of say, hey, you, worker, you're the problem. Maybe the problem was that they did not have any leadership for 5 or 6 years, that they didn't have any vision and they didn't have any plan that people could rally behind. So taking it out on people who were working remotely does not seem like that was an apt strategy. In fact, it seems like it was punishing people for basically a management problem, which, okay, she has to clean something up and maybe there's some collateral damage there that has to happen. What I find funny is that it sort of started a little bit of a trend. Companies who were in deep, deep trouble saw this as somehow this was going to right their ship. Best Buy just announced not too long ago that they were going to do the same thing. Best Buy is in a pretty bad spiral downward, and they announced, well, I guess Yahoo was in the same sinking ship situation. Their rally cry became all hands on deck. And this is not going to save them, of course. Just forcing people to come into the office, especially people who've grown accustomed to sort of the quality of life that comes from working remotely. Do you think that they're going to be excellent workers just because you force them to come into the office from 9 to 5? Of course they're not. They're going to be excellent workers if you give them an excellent vision to rally behind. But just sort of saying, well, remote work is a big part of our problem. We can't have that anymore. That's unlikely to inspire anybody. So other theories I've seen was that this was basically a thinly veiled approach to cutting a part of the workforce. But I think at Yahoo, they had some 11,000 people and 500 of them were working remotely. So if that was the way to basically fire people on the fly, it didn't seem like a very sort of big measure. And second of all, were you really going to think that there was a perfect parity between the poorest workers at Yahoo and the people who work remotely? Of course not. I mean, I'm sure out of those 500 people they had working there remotely, tons of those were great workers doing great things, and now they're going to look for employment elsewhere.
Hmm. William in Columbus, you're on the air with David Hansen. Welcome, William.
Hello, how are you this morning?
Fine, thanks.
Good. I just wanted to comment on actually your position. I have a nephew in Atlanta that travels with for two different radio stations, and he can attend one sports event and go to a quiet room, broadcast, take calls, and then go out and cover another. So I was intrigued. I do enjoy you sitting at your desk and
watching me doodle. Yeah,
but. I just wanted to comment that there is a sector of the radio industry that's already mobile and going around and doing that. But
you're absolutely right. It's just public media. I don't know if we can. We do remote sometimes, but I know what you mean. Yeah, you're
okay,
right.
Okay, yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay, but stay put at least with that show. You're a terrific asset to our community.
Thank you, William.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Bye.
Bye-bye. Bill in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I just wanted to, I just caught into the tail end of this conversation, but I run a solo law practice out of my home. I do patent law, and so it's a federal practice, and I've got clients that are in California. I've got clients in Canada that I've never met, and I deal with the patent office electronically. And I have interviews using GoToMeeting and the like. And so it's a perfect situation. My commute is 14 steps downstairs.
When did you switch to this, or has it always been your practice this way?
No, I worked for a law firm and a local company for a while, but I've just been a solo practice since 2006. And I decided to practice out of my home. It's a paperless office, and it's just worked wonderfully. And the technology is improving, and it's just getting better.
David Hansen, this is probably a really good example of what works.
Absolutely, and it's a great example of where this works now. I mean, 20 years ago, the technology just wasn't that great to do this. Most people just weren't set up to, even if you were willing to go remote, the people you were working with, the vendors you had, or the patent office, we're not willing to do those things. Now we're in a much different situation, and I just don't think that most people have caught up to that fact, that the world has changed. It's so much easier now that it's possible in far more industries than people would think. If you talk to somebody who doesn't know anything about remote work and you say, oh, lawyers can work remotely, the knee-jerk reaction would be, well, that doesn't make sense. They have to meet clients in person, or they have to go to court, or they have to do all these things. Well, there are certainly factions of legal work that can be done remotely, but there's also large factions that can, as this gentleman is demonstrating very aptly.
Okay, Bill, thanks a lot for that call. You mentioned when it comes to the Yahoo case that it wasn't a really, if what they were trying to achieve was getting rid of low productivity and pressuring the lower producers to inside and maybe to keep an eye on them. How do you measure? And of course, the last caller isn't a good example. He works for himself. He's his own boss. But how do you measure productivity? How do you make sure that they're not cruising Facebook? Or is that just part of life nowadays, is cruising the internet, checking out Facebook and Twitter and so forth?
Well, two things. First of all, you have to supervise the work, not the person.
Okay.
If you try to basically run your company by just supervising people, making sure that they're at their desk from 9 to 5 and they don't take too long lunch breaks and so forth, you're really doing a very ineffective job. And people are exceptionally good at gaming that system. They're exceptionally good at living down to your low expectations. So if you're a boss and you think that the one thing your employees want to do is slack off as much as possible, well, you're kind of setting yourself up for a situation where people are going to try to do just that. What we found with remote work is if you trust your employees, if you think that they're actually interested in doing a good job and that they derive satisfaction from doing a great job, you have the opposite problem. We've never had an underwork problem. We've had overwork problems out the years. We have to keep a tab on making sure that people actually take enough vacation, that they don't work too long hours, because there are some pitfalls with remote work where if you don't pay attention to it, it can be hard at times to set good boundaries. When are you at work and when are you off? When you're just working out of your home or elsewhere, it can be very easy to blend these two things too much. So we found that it's a fantasy. It's a manager's fantasy to think that all employees just want to goof off, and if they work from home, they'll just sit in front of daytime TV and play video games. It's really not what most people are interested in doing. And unfortunately, I'd say that that's part of that toxic atmosphere that makes talking about remote work a little hard. First, you have to solve the underlying trust issue and make it such that managers will trust your employees, because otherwise it's hard to make progress on anything.
Oh, we'll squeeze in one more call. Eric in Columbus, you're on the air again with David Hansen. He's the author of Remote, Office Not Required. Hi.
Hi, David. So you're talking about, you know, old traditional methods becoming kind of obsolete due to technologies. And I've been reading a lot of books, articles, you know, et cetera, on how automated technologies, advanced algorithms, artificial intelligence, and robotics are making some jobs obsolete. And considering that our computing power is advancing exponentially, do you have any perspective on, like, the long-term implications of unemployment and jobs in general?
Sure. I mean, creative destruction has been going on for a very long time. This is part of that cycle where, as economies shift, we need different people to do different things. We just don't need as many people in person doing A, B, and C. But then hopefully the idea is that we're going to need new people perhaps programming those robots and setting up those systems and so forth. And part of it will be at times we just don't need as many people in one segment of the economy. I mean, we used to have lots of people working in agriculture, and now there's less than 2% of the U.S. population working in agriculture. How is that going to shape out? Is there always going to be a replacement for creative destruction? I think that's a very good question, and nobody's going to really have the answer for that. So far, if we look in the rearview mirror, it's been true. Like, when we've had creative destruction and we've had areas of work that no longer need to be done, we found new areas of work and new things for people to do. Might require retraining, and that can be very painful for individuals who sort of are trapped in an industry that's going away. But as a society, we're certainly much better off that we don't still have, 60% of the population working in agriculture. It's a richer society today because of it. But who knows if that's going to stay true for the next 20, 50, or 100 years. I don't think anybody has that answer. I think I'm optimistic that that's the case. First of all, just from looking at yesterday's weather, that we've been able to do so, and also just because it looks like we constantly come up with new things. The human species seems to be pretty ingenious about coming up with new ways of making themselves relevant.
Well, Eric, thanks for that call. And David Hansen, thank you so much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
David Hansen, he's author of Remote, Office Not Required. Tech Tuesday will continue on All Sides with Ann Fisher in just a minute. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Joining me now, Russell Holly. Last week, we heard some predictions about the big announcements Apple would unveil at its 2013 iPad event. And Russell is back this week to tell us whether the rumor mill got it right or wrong. Welcome back to the show, Russell.
Thank you.
Now you say that with a lot of enthusiasm, but you're actually very not happy.
You're disappointed. So Apple had their press event just like we knew was going to happen, and they did bring two new iPads, creation. They will be available on sale this Friday, but they weren't quite what I was expecting based on everything that had been talked about in the weeks prior. We have two new devices now. The first is the iPad Air, which is the successor to the 9.7-inch iPad, the larger of the two iPads. It is exactly 1 pound, which makes it the lightest of the tablets in that size. Has a the same processor in it that is in the iPhone 5S, which makes it nice and fast, and has the same Retina screen. They basically took the iPad and made it a little faster and a lot thinner, so that it had a very nice place. And then they took the iPad Mini. And they gave it a Retina display as well as the same processor that's in the iPhone 5S. So it's also very fast now and has a nicer display. It got a price jump as a result. It went from being a $329 tablet to a $399 tablet. Mm-hmm. And both of these tablets also have their predecessors available for sale if you want the less expensive version. Although in both of those cases, it's like $100 difference, and you lose a whole lot more than $100 if you step down to that previous model for both of those devices. But neither tablet comes with the Touch ID fingerprint sensor.
Right, which is what we were so excited about.
I was very excited about that. I was very excited to get one myself because I actually broke my last iPad Mini and was very interested in replacing it. But I'm not totally sure that I'm going to anymore, because not only is there a price hike that makes it the same cost as the lowest model iPad 9.7-inch, but it doesn't have the Touch ID sensor that I really, really like from the iPhone 5S.
Do you have any sense about why? I mean, why aren't they?
It seems like something that was probably... Apple could probably only get so many of them manufactured, and the iPhone 5S has sold really tremendously well. So it's most likely, if I really had to guess, that getting that many Touch ID sensors made for all three of these devices was probably very difficult. So I would imagine that that's something we will see in the next generation of those devices. Whereas for the next year, the iPhone 5S will be the only thing with the Touch ID sensor.
Well, I'd really like to get an iPad. I'm the only one in my family that doesn't have one now. But I really like the idea of the touch sensor, and I probably would want to wait now.
Yeah, I feel exactly the same way. The price hike for the iPad Mini was a little on the odd side because when Apple did the same upgrade to the 9.7-inch device, there was no price hike there. So it was a little curious to see those decisions made as far as the iPads go. We did also see new MacBook Pros and the new Mac Pro desktop. Both of those are pretty significant boosts as far as power goes. The MacBooks have new processors in them that give them significantly better battery life. And it hasn't been fully tested as to how long they last, but the same processor is in the new MacBook Air, and that got 10 hours for most people. So that seemed like a really good idea.
Okay. A lot of the new Apple products come with a Retina display. That was, one of the biggest changes, right?
Yeah. So everything in Apple's portfolio now has the Retina high DPI display. So it essentially, the iPad Mini was really the only one that kind of stood out, without having that. And so now they've all got it in the most current line. If you purchase the previous version of the iPad that's on the shelves right now, which was another really odd move from Google, or from Apple rather, the iPad 2 is what you can purchase for $100 cheaper than the iPad Air. And it does not have a Retina display, but that's not last year's model iPad. It's actually one more year back.
Huh.
because last year's model did have a Retina display for the 9.7-inch tablet. So you really do lose a lot if you go and buy the iPad 2. It's $100 cheaper, but it's significantly less device in both processor and display, and even battery life expectancy will likely be significantly less.
Email from Julie. Is there any plan for iPads to run the Adobe Flash software that plays videos? It is very frustrating not to be able to watch so many videos that are on Facebook and other sites.
There is an application for Facebook that will enable Flash videos on the iPad. It is a browser whose name escapes me. Oh, Skyfire. Skyfire is the name of the browser. If you use Skyfire on any iOS device, then you can get Flash videos from things like Facebook. But if you're looking for native Flash support, that is just never going to happen. Apple is no big fan of Flash, and even the other operating systems in the mobile space, Google's Android and Windows Phone from Microsoft, have also phased out Flash support in exchange for HTML5. So that is not something that is ever going to be native to iOS, but there are ways around it with Skyfire.
Are the ways around it efficient, or do they use a lot of power, or what?
It's not that it's power hungry. It's as efficient as Flash can be. But what you really are getting is the whole web experience from kind of a traditional browser. So if Flash crashes, then you'll get that same experience on your browser. You get the good with the bad there. But you also have to go to the websites to get that experience. You're not going to be able to install Skyfire and then open the Facebook app and see Flash things. So you're going to be using it as though you were using a desktop browser.
You know, sometimes people say, why do we talk about Apple so much? Apple's big.
Yeah, I mean, so I talk about Apple a lot because I'm a mobile writer.
Right.
And
that's
Apple's,
why we talk to you.
Yeah, Apple's one of the bigger deals in this particular group. But yeah, it's definitely, they have this time of year where they push out kind of all of their big stuff. And then the rest of the year, we won't talk about them quite as much unless an app developer has done something really cool specifically for the iPhone. Most of the rest of the year, we end up talking about, Android and Windows.
Right, exactly. Let's see. Moving on then. News about the new Sony gaming system, the PS4. First, tell us what we were expecting from the PS4.
Okay, so if you have made a pre-order for the PlayStation 4, the console will be available in about 3 weeks. Where you'll be able to go into stores and pick it up, and there'll be lots of people standing in very long lines to get their very shiny boxes. But when you take it out of the box, it is very important that the first thing you do is connect it to the internet and install the update that will be available to everyone the very first time that they plug the console in. This isn't particularly uncommon for new consoles, but in this case, you'll notice if you try to use it without a connection to the internet, that a lot of the features for the PlayStation 4 are going to be missing, including the ability to watch Blu-rays that actually won't work on the PlayStation 4 until you've gotten this update. So it's really important. This is just kind of a PSA that I wanted to talk about. when you get the PlayStation 4, it is really important that you connect to the internet and do the first update. You probably don't ever need to connect it to the internet again after that if you don't want to. Because most of the other updates will come along with discs for the games themselves. But so that's, if you have this set up for a child and you don't want it constantly connected to the internet, it's not something that is a requirement. But for this one update, it's a really, really good idea to do so.
Do they make that clear on the box, at the shiny box?
They do not make it clear on the shiny box. This is something that Sony announced earlier this week as kind of a warning to people who had pre-ordered. They put it up on their website and haven't really talked about it a lot since then. So I wanted to make sure, because it's one of those Christmas things. A lot of people are going to be wanting to get PlayStation 4s as Christmas presents, and or maybe just picking it up for themselves when it comes out in the next couple of weeks. And so that is one of those things that will make your gaming experience not great if you try and play a game without connecting it to the internet first.
John in Columbus, you're on the air with Russell Holly from Geek.com. Welcome.
Great. Yeah, I had a quick question. I've been running into, and I admit it's kind of a pet peeve, but I've been running into different people that say this particular thing, and I can't get them to explain why, and I think it's because they heard somebody else say it. But they, you know, I'll ask them why they prefer the Android over an iPhone. I'm talking about smartphones here. And they'll say, well, it's much more, I know, open source. You can do a lot more with it, all this different stuff. And I've had Android. I've had an iPhone. And now I think for some people it's probably really relevant. But is it me or are there a bunch of people out there that talk about this and don't ever use it anyway because there's how many apps on Apple? They're all normally vetted and solid. And it's your typical user probably isn't really taking advantage of, I don't know whether it's open source or whatever else on the Android thing. Is it me or is that just they're just kind of talking about things they don't know about?
I think that on a high level, using open source as a reason for Android for most people is kind of an empty statement. But there is something to be said for the benefit of giving open source to developers and letting them work on apps that can perform in very specific ways. One of the key examples of that is how content gets shared across applications in Android. For example, you go to take a picture, and from that picture, you can immediately share to Facebook or Google Plus or send it to an email or even as a text message. You can do all of that from one centralized location because Google has built the operating system so that the apps are forced to interoperate with one another. Whereas in the Apple ecosystem, each app is kind of in its contained closed locker. And so you end up having to take a photo and then leave the camera application, go to the application you want to share from, and then search for your photo through the gallery. And then select it and share. And this is, you know, one example of many as to why this system ends up being very different. And that's, you know, overall, that's how these two organizations chose to let individual developers operate with one another. So when people say open source, it may be kind of an empty statement that they don't understand why it's significant. But when you look at that kind of interoperability, that happens because Google has given these developers the tools to do that. And that's something Apple hasn't done.
Okie doke, John, thanks a lot for that call. We appreciate it. Speaking of Android, there's a new Android app called Aviate. You wanted to talk about it.
Yeah, Aviate was kind of a cool thing that I stumbled upon last week, the week before, and I spent a week with it. When you think about your home screen for whatever operating system you have, it ends up being this thing that you kind of put together yourself. Like, you know, for the iPhone, you take your apps and you put them in whatever folders you want and you organize them however you want. And for Android, you set your background, you apply whatever widgets you want to the home screen and, you drag your icons to wherever you want to go and you kind of create your own experience. And it ends up being a little on the time-consuming side. And if you lose everything, you know, you need to replace your phone or whatever, then you end up going and just kind of doing all of this stuff over again. What I found really cool about Aviate is that it is, in a way that is not dissimilar from Google Now, designed to take how you use your phone and use that to actually build your home screen for you. And this was something that I used for a little while. It took, you know, a week roughly to figure out all of my, you know, different activities, how I went and reached for different apps and when I reached for those different apps. And it assembled this kind of custom user experience for me so that when I woke up in the morning, my home screen had my alarm clock control panel so that I could either turn off my alarm clock or set it for, you know, a 10-minute snooze or whatever. But then it also had the news application that I opened first thing in the morning, my email that I usually open first thing in the morning, and you know, any other applications that it felt like I would normally use at that time of day. And in about an hour, by the time I've, you know, showered and gotten my kids up and ready for go, those apps are now gone from the home screen and are replaced with other applications that I would normally use at that time of the day. Hmm. And this process continues entirely. When I sit down in my office or when I drive to the post office or anything like that, it is taken those behaviors and used that to create a home screen where it, you know, the apps that it thinks I'm going to use are now right within thumb's reach. And it was a really cool experience to play with for a little while. I wrote kind of a review about how it works, and it's definitely a unique experience.
Of course, everybody can read everything Russell Holly writes for geek.com. So check that out whenever you can. Russell, thanks a lot. And by the way, we had some calls at the last minute. Get your calls in earlier, folks. But Russell will be back next week, as he is on every Tech Tuesday. So Russell, thanks again for today.
Thanks for having me.
Russell Holly, he's a tech blogger for geek.com. Thanks to everybody for listening to Tech Tuesday today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.